And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for being here with us on the Sunday morning wake-up call. What a fun day. It's a beautiful day. It's a little chilly, though. If you're just looking out the window, it looks like one of those beautiful summer days, and it ain't. Our guest today, you know, we're going to be talking politics. So get set, get ready, let's go. Our guest, Jeff Skelly, he is from UVA Center for Politics and a key participant in making Larry Sabato's crystal ball come to life. Good morning, Jeff.
Hey, morning. Thanks for having me on.
Well, as always, I thank everybody for making the time. Sunday from 11 to 12, you know, it's you get to sleep in, but it gets in the way of brunch.
Yeah, it is a key brunch time, so yeah. I know I'm giving up a lot here.
Yes, you are giving up a lot, and we appreciate that. We will be talking politics, political races, what's going on in the world, what's going on in Virginia, what's going on in the United States, because you, my man, have the background.
Yes, UVA Center for Politics is one of the many little institutions over the University of Virginia, but our focus is on improving civic engagement, and we have a number of programs that aim to do that, whether it's the Youth Leadership Initiative, which aims to work with kids and help teachers in how they work with kids in terms of teaching civics and understanding what goes on in American governance, or Global Perspectives on Democracy, which sort of extends that mission abroad. We bring in groups from all around the world to try to instill sort of civic education, and the crystal ball, which is what I do mainly, along with communications for the center. But
The website for that?
Well, centerforpolitics.org is our organization's website, and if you tack on / crystal ball, one word at the end of that, you end up with our website for our weekly newsletter, which we keep sort of abreast of what's going on in contemporary American politics and race ratings and, you know, close analysis of what's happening in, like, the presidential contest, the Senate contest, gubernatorial contests, and other stuff like that.
Yeah, I find that too. It's always crucial, and I would assume, and assuming always a key factor in my life, is that you do list all the, especially, and I'm talking mostly about the presidential candidates at this point, you do list all the candidates who are still in the race and where they fall. You do it by tier, tier one, tier two, and then lower levels. And the currently, I think that the rankings or ratings have been coming out every 8 weeks or so. But I'm assuming that they're going to get to be a little more frequent.
Yes, so far, because we haven't actually gotten into the actual primary election season. I know it seems crazy to think, but we're still just a little under 2 months until there's actual voting, despite all the attention that's obviously been paid to the contest so far. But yeah, it's sort of been inconsistent in our updates of it. Much has depended on maybe there was a Republican or a Democratic debate that we thought was a good time, or you know, their developments in the race at this point are inconsistent in terms of their impact. So yeah, we will be updating it even more regularly than we already are. But we have plenty of analysis that is very, very regularly updated.
Yeah, I find them, and the articles come out a lot more than the change in the tier rankings, that I was referring to. It's a great source of information.
Thanks.
That you should check out. The visuals, the maps that are there. There's bits of information that are sort of the, I think the. There was the guest that the homegrown folks just talked to said something about today's culture being a microwave culture, needing information quick and fast. And there's some of that is there on the crystal ball page, where you can see little bullets of tidbits for each candidate and what their pros and cons are, or at least as judged by others, not necessarily by the crystal ball folks. And then a lot more in-depth things, the maps that you can see. It's I find it to be really helpful and really important in gathering information.
I'm glad to hear that.
Well, darn well better be, because that's why Jeff Skelly's here today.
Exactly.
So again, Jeff Skelly here. We're going to talk about political races here on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville 94.7. So Jeff, jump right into it. How have the crystal ball predictions changed? Because the 2016 race has been going on for, we'll say, 3 years, although that's well, a little more realistically, for a year anyway, or certainly 6 to 9 months.
I think a year is fair. Jeb Bush sort of unofficially announced that he was going to be running in December of 2014. So we've been essentially going for about a year now.
And when the first tier, that's not, well, I won't say that, when Jeb Bush some time ago, several months ago, one of the early predictors from the crystal ball had Jeb Bush listed on the first tier. Is that am I using the proper jargon from the crystal ball?
Yes. We have it separated out into tiers just for sort of ease and understanding.
Top level, second level, third level, lower level.
The number of tiers has varied in terms of who we thought sort of belonged together or not. And sometimes there's contextual descriptions with those as well in terms of maybe who they're appealing to. Sometimes the tiers are actually kind of murky in terms of do they actually mean that someone is literally ahead, but we provide context if that's the case.
But Jeb Bush, when he started, was considered to be a top-level possibility, top-level candidate.
Oh, absolutely. He still has a lot of money behind him. His super PAC, Right to Rise, has at one point had raised about $100 million. Surely they have more now, and still had a lot of that in the bank. And so I think a lot of people felt that that kind of money and those kinds of resources were going to really boost Bush. Moreover, the Bush name, it's one of the most powerful names in Republican politics historically. I mean, we've had two President Bushes.
Is the oligarchy continues?
I mean, it's certainly disconcerting. I mean, it's disconcerting on the Democratic side, too, with Hillary Clinton running. The dynasty is a somewhat disturbing thing in American politics, because you feel like we live in a society where could come up through, you know.
You would
and
think
run.
For some of us it's disturbing, but yes. Apparently for many people it's not.
Well, it's proven disturbing enough. I don't know if you can really chalk it up to that entirely, but clearly Jeb Bush it's not worked out for him the way everybody was sort of expecting him to be in the hunt for the nomination. Instead, he's basically struggling to stay relevant, and I don't think anyone really anticipated that. His super PAC and his campaign has been spending millions of dollars in some of the early states on advertisements, trying to build him up, sort of redefine him, if that's even possible, since his last name is Bush, and people make natural associations with that. And unfortunately for him, those have been negative associations largely, because a lot of conservative Republicans think that his older brother's presidency saw a lot of sort of violations of conservative spirit, where you're thinking about No Child Left Behind, if you're thinking about attempts to reform, do comprehensive immigration reform, lots of government expansion with like Medicare Part D, those kinds of.
But that's background, or seeming to me anyway, that's background issues that has possibly hurt him. What seems to have hurt him in the front is the inability to answer a simple question such as, would you make a different decision about going into Iraq?
Yes.
Knowing the information that we have today? And he's like,
he waffles. He waffles.
You know,
yeah,
I don't know.
Actually, I think what's probably been the most interesting thing is that a lot of people viewed Jeb Bush as having been a relatively successful governor in terms of popular opinion, seemed to view him as having been
in a difficult
good.
State.
Yeah, in a you know, pretty competitive Florida, which is one of the, you know, one of the key swing states in presidential politics, and is a very competitive state politically. And he came out of that with a pretty good job approval rating. He was viewed favorably, but it turns out that he may be a pretty good leader in that kind of context. But on the campaign trail, he's proven to be pretty mediocre. He's tended to sort of put his foot in his mouth a lot. I mean, whether it's answering questions about Iraq or making just kind of silly, weird, awkward comments. He was asked about like his favorite superhero. This is like one of my favorite little examples. He was asked about his favorite superhero, and he couldn't really give a good answer to that. But he mentioned that he'd seen this, you know, clips of this new show Supergirl, and he thought it looked pretty cool, this new television show Supergirl, and that the lead character was pretty hot.
Yeah.
It was just very strange. Like he's just not a natural campaigner. And it's funny because so many people, when George W. Bush was making inroads into national politics, so many people were like, well, Jeb Bush seems like he's perhaps a little bit savvier than his brother. But it turns out that George W. Bush is much better at the game of politics. He's much better at working a room. He's much better at being a political being than his younger brother has proven to be.
Right. The question is, would Jeb Bush make better decisions but not necessarily be better in front of all the cameras?
As it's turned out, at least on the campaign trail, George W. Bush was far better than Jeb Bush.
So Jeb Bush has, as far as the crystal ball presidential nomination rankings, and again, we're not talking 1 through 16. This is sort of a grouping of probable top level,
right,
second tier, etc., that Jeb Bush has dropped.
Yes.
And I think for many people, surprisingly.
I mean, again, there were so many reasons to think he had a lot of advantages. Something I haven't even brought up is that he had and still has a lot of support from the Republican establishment. And historically, and this election season is basically trying to stamp all over historical tendencies, but historically, the candidate that has received most support from the establishment has wound up being the nominee on the Republican side, and to a large extent also on the Democratic side. And the Republican establishment, many of them, through private conversations or just public that we've had with people, or through just their public utterances, it's not hard to read between the lines. They like Bush. They think that he will be a competent leader of the party, leader on a presidential ticket. That he would be, an incredible fundraiser, could have all kinds of positive repercussions for the rest of the party. And many got behind him early, and actually, as it turned out, because his numbers have really not gone anywhere but down, all things considered, a lot of that support and endorsements and whatnot has actually sort of slowed to a trickle, though he's still getting some new endorsements, but most of them came pretty early on before it became sort of obvious that he was a lot weaker than anyone could have anticipated.
11:16 here on the Wake Up Call. Our guest, Jeff Skelly, he's with UVA Center for Politics and a key player in Larry Sabato's crystal ball. So talking about some changes over the last year in the crystal ball, it's hard not to talk about Donald Trump. I'm one of those people.
Took us 15 minutes,
yeah,
but yeah.
But it did. And that was sort of I wanted to do that. I didn't want to mention him first. But in the earlier phases, he was listed as...
Oh, and also ran.
And also ran.
Absolutely.
Right. And he got some special tidbits on the side, which I, because it's been a year ago, but I was noticing, which was he could cause some trouble because he can fund his own campaign. And because he, even a year ago, he was saying things that were getting attention, and he was saying things that were sort of making the established GOP, cringe. But I noticed that in one of the latest tiers, he's first tier. He's been moved from the side of the pie.
Yes.
into the center.
I mean, that's the thing that people need to understand, is that for all the talk about things being predetermined or something, campaigns still have to be waged, and candidates that we might think are strong, say Jeb Bush, can prove to be a lot weaker than we ever could have realized or just guessed at the start based on what we knew about them. And with Donald Trump, the expectation was, well, he's a blowhard. He's been loud. He's boisterous.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, yes, his appeal is limited. He's not going to have the ability to get any support from like the Republican establishment. It's just difficult to see where his path is. He's got terrible numbers. This is actually probably the most interesting thing, is his favorability numbers initially among Republicans in national and state polling was terrible. It was extremely negative. It was Chris Christie level of net negative. Christie's actually managed to improve his numbers a little bit, but Trump has seen a complete reversal of his numbers in a way that I don't think anyone has ever done. There have been some articles written about this by other people, but there really is no easy comparison in modern American politics for someone to have so completely reversed the view among the people who are going to be voting on this individual, at least in this context of the Republican primary, to so drastically shift from having had a largely negative opinion to a largely positive one for him. Now, there are still a lot of Republicans. In fact, he still leads most of the polling questions asked, is there someone in the Republican field you wouldn't support among Republicans? And he still is the leading recipient of those individuals asked, respondents in polls. The most people say they wouldn't support him. But at the same time, he's also getting the most support. So at the end of the day, he has become the front runner. But I think it remains. I'm still skeptical, and remain skeptical that he will end up being the Republican nominee. However, I can say very confidently that over the last 6 months, our view of the possibility of a Donald Trump nomination has gone from not a chance, no way, will never happen, to it could happen.
He reminds me of, it's stuck in my head, so I probably read it somewhere, maybe even on Crystal Ball. He reminds me of like a wrestling villain where
he's the heel.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how he plays himself. And there's very small number of people who know his true personality that I think that the way he acts is, yes, I'll say it, such a trumped up version of who he really is, that he's acting. He is the wrestling villain. He's playing a role that he enjoys doing, that is obviously getting a lot of attention. And there's always, I mean, doesn't matter. There always has to be the heel. The evil villain against the superhero.
I think with Trump that probably played a role with it initially with his bid, you know, and he had previously bandied about the idea that he would run for president in 2012 most recently. And honestly, a lot of us were just like, whatever, you can keep talking about running for president, but until you actually declare you're running for president, we're just not going to give you the time of day because you've said this so many times. It's a boy cried wolf problem. Well, then he announced, and then everybody's like, well, we'll see if he actually files like the required paperwork with the Federal Election Commission, such as full financial disclosures. Well, then he did that. And then we're like, okay, well, he's really in this time, but still didn't really expect much to come of it. And then, you know, he started talking about immigration, and he was expounding very, very anti-illegal immigrant rhetoric, and it really caught fire with a good chunk of the Republican base. And I think what's really happened now is that you have an interesting situation where if you look at the polling, Donald Trump has an overwhelming lead in the national polls, and we can talk about the value.
Among assholes?
Well,
I can say that on WPBC.
We could talk about the actual validity of polls at this point, but it is worth noting that he has a very strong hold over white voters who don't have a college degree, whereas the white voters who do have a college degree are extremely divided, and many are supporting Trump. In the polls, but it's a much more divided field with, you know, fairly even between like Carson, Rubio, and Trump and Cruz, whereas among those without a college degree, which increasingly has become an important part of the Republican base, because you have a lot of areas of the country that have swung rather sharply toward Republicans over the last couple decades, particularly in the Deep South and sort of Appalachia. And you have a lot more blue-collar voters sort of in the Republican base than maybe there used to be, what may have once been called Reagan Democrats, though that those don't really even exist anymore. So it's like one of those terms that I think is very archaic. But at the end of the day, these voters are going to play a role in the nomination process. And this time, they are not unified, but a much larger block of them is behind one candidate. And that, I think, is an important part of this because you have a lot of candidates still in the Republican field, obviously, a record number. And support for Trump is highest, but it's not really that high. He's around 30%, 25 to 30 in most polls. And that's – but when the rest of the field is divided – the rest of the 70% or whatever, 70 to 75% is divided among 13 other people – well, suddenly 25, 26, 27% is looking pretty good. And obviously some of those candidates are going to drop out. But that's why he's in the lead. And he's continued. People keep waiting for him to fall, and he hasn't.
1124 here on the Sunday morning wake-up call with our guest, Jeff Skelly. Jeff is from UVA Center for Politics and Larry Sabatow's Crystal Ball.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel, with six area locations. Democracy Now! Is supported in part by Market Street Wine Shops, downtown at 311 East Market Street, and uptown in the Rivanna Plaza in front of Kegler's, featuring not only wine and craft beers, but the expertise to help you select a libation for any occasion. An up-to-date list of wine and beer tastings at both locations is always at marketstreetwine.com.
And thanks for listening to Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. We will take phone calls, 284-9470. That's 434-284-9470. Because the station's new, we realize everybody's a new listener here at WPVC. Jeff Skelly here. You know, Jeff, before the break, you talked about how there's still a whole lot of people in the Republican field. Did you think that the field would have thinned a lot more by now?
Well, many people threw around the idea that maybe it wouldn't thin very quickly and that it may not even in the long run, just because in the post – well, since the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission decision by the Supreme Court in 2010 really opened up outside money spigots in American politics, threw off all the limitations, and now essentially you can have unlimited outside spending in federal elections. Many people thought, well, all these candidates have these super PACs that they're allied with that are backing their candidacy, and of course there's supposedly no coordination because that's illegal, but you have people moving back and forth between the campaigns, which, I mean, between like a campaign and a super PAC associated with that candidate. So one would have to think that they're probably just kind of working around the edges of coordination there. But at the end of the day, we figured, well, if you can raise a few million dollars or have a couple rich backers behind you propping up the super PAC that could spend money on your behalf, we saw in 2012, that really enabled Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum to stay in the game for much longer than anyone would have expected. With Santorum, you had Foster Freeze, a billionaire who's giving him a lot of money. With Newt Gingrich, you had Sheldon Adelson giving a lot of money to him. And those individuals were basically the main funders of these outside groups that were backing their candidacy. So they were sort of acting as a third party working on behalf of the candidate. And so with the unlimited money potential, if you could just have one supporter who's really wealthy behind you or behind your super PAC, that could probably enable you to stay in the race, even if you had a very small amount of candidate committee money that you could then spend on staff and whatnot. But at the end of the day, you'd have somebody who could pay for lots of TV ads and pay for things like that. So maybe candidates would be able to stay in longer. But I think at this point, what's proven to be really interesting is that just because you have a lot of money behind you in a super PAC doesn't mean you're going to actually stay in the race. And Scott Walker really showed this. A lot of analysts, including the Crystal Ball, expected Scott Walker to be a pretty, potentially a very competitive candidate in this field. And you know what he might have been, except his campaign ramped up before it really was established. And by what I mean by that is his polling numbers were really good in Iowa. So his campaign started creating offices, hiring people, all this stuff before they actually had the money that they were anticipating. And then when his support fell off real sharply, because he didn't do that well in debates, he made some comments that got him into a little trouble with potential donors, on comments sort of like questioning whether there should be even as much legal immigration as there is, which the business class and the Republican Party is not going to be a fan of. Those kinds of things got him into some trouble, so his support fell off, and so the money that his campaign always expected to get in the candidate committee, which can pay for the staffers, pay for the offices, you can't siphon that off to the super PACs. That money never really came in at the levels they expected. So you had this completely overextended operation. And so that's what really forced Walker out, is that he couldn't keep going. And Rick Perry actually did something similar, except at kind of a smaller level. So neither of those guys are able to survive. So just because you have outside money support, you still have to be smart about the money you're using with your campaign committees. That was always kind of expected to be... I think a lot of us expected the outside money to allow more candidates to stay in, but it's interesting because it hasn't proven necessarily to be the case. And so with someone like George Pataki or Jim Gilmore, I mean, they essentially have no money because they don't have any outside money because no one's supporting them, but they also have like no money in their candidate committee. So, you know, at the end of the day, are they going to actually last till February 1st, which is when the Iowa caucuses are? Pretty skeptical. So I think there'll be some further winnowing of the field over the next month and a half.
Still, we're talking realistically of having a good 8 to 10, yeah. I use the word strong, candidates.
Oh, elected people who have won statewide races. I mean, you think about like John Kasich and Chris Christie, they're governors of large industrial states. I mean, John Kasich is governor of the most of what has been traditionally and probably remains the most important swing state. Because if you're a Republican presidential candidate, you basically cannot win without Ohio.
Right.
So Ohio, New Jersey, these are big states, and these are governors in their second terms. So they have track records of electoral success. And yet Chris Christie and John Kasich are basically – their futures are entirely tied to how well they can do in New Hampshire.
Do Iowa and New Hampshire have too much say – in what happens in a presidential election?
It's a good thing that I have no interest in ever running for office, because
I mean, it's sort of,
my answer would be yes.
It sort of feels like it's the old timey, you know, like let's go to the Albemarle County, you know, county fair, mm-hmm. and take a look at the way things used to be. Isn't that cool? That old timey tractor, and we still have the pie contest and other stuff. And I'm like, wait a minute. It seems like it's nice to hear about and it's nice to see happen, but damn, there's a lot of stuff that comes due because we let that happen.
Well, basically there are two sides to this, of course, like there are to most things. On the pro side, in favor of New Hampshire and Iowa, is that they have a long track record of doing this, and so actually their electorates are much more tuned in to the process, to candidate abilities, to actually sort of critiquing candidates. So they would argue that the system is good in that sense because they have a lot of practice at it, particularly New Hampshire, which has had a primary since, I believe, 1912 and has been first for a very, very, very long time. The Iowa caucuses really only go back to 1972 in terms of their impact. But nonetheless, they have a long history of doing this. They're very practiced at it. Actually, there's a really interesting article in Politico about how Iowa, despite being lily white and just not very diverse in that sense, it's actually very diverse in terms of background. And there are arguments about like where people come from, like their ancestry and whatnot, actually having sort of an impact on their political ideology. So it was actually a really, really interesting article, and there's perhaps some merits to it. On the flip side, of course, well, if other people got a chance to go first, they could probably get pretty good at critiquing candidates too. And at the same time, there are a lot of states that are a lot more representative of the country at large. We live in a very diverse society, and Iowa and New Hampshire, at the end of the day, do not really reflect the country we live in at large. So I think those are the arguments against it. I should also mention, though, that one of the reasons why we are in this situation, where Iowa and New Hampshire lead off, is that the parties have largely gone along with that as a scheduling tool. And until there's some kind of, I'm actually not sure what the legal requirements would be to make it, but unless the parties really were to push the idea of like national primary day of some kind, which I don't think they will, because actually, honestly, I'm against that personally, because I think that the campaigns offer, you know, the process offers voters a chance to see candidates actually have to be challenged on their positions. You know, if everybody voted on the same day, like the entire country for whatever party, you know, are you really testing the candidate? Are you really putting them through the rigmarole?
Right, that's popularity and money again.
Yeah, yeah. So actually, I think the campaign process is very good. I think there are good arguments, perhaps, for a regional primary system where certain groups of states would take turns leading off. And I think that would be probably the best solution. But it's very hard to see that ever actually happening. So we've ended up in a situation where, at least this year, actually, everybody seems to be obeying the scheduling rules the two parties have set out. So there's no one like going too early in the process trying to get ahead. So you've got Iowa on February 1st, and then you have New Hampshire on February 9th. And then a couple weeks later, you have the South Carolina primary, which is actually, it's just a little bit later on, and then the Nevada caucuses. And so those are the four February contests. And actually, Nevada caucuses take place on different days, depending whether they're talking about the Democrats or Republicans. But those four states end up sort of being the leadoff. And then you have a ton of states going on March 1st, including Virginia.
Jeff Skelly here. He's our guest today. We're talking about the political races. Jeff is from UVA's Center for Politics and a key player at Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball. You should Google that. You can find all kinds of information, really informative maps. Check it out. You were talking about, my question was, do Iowa and New Hampshire play too key of a role? Well, you wrote an article recently on do white evangelicals have too much of a control over the GOP nominees? Share a little bit about that.
Sure. I think my answer to that was maybe not. It's like many things, there's nothing black and white. It's very nuanced. But most of the early states in the nomination process, or not most, but a large chunk of the delegates from those states are going to be from states where the Republican primary or caucus electorates are going to have very large percentages of white evangelicals. And white evangelical Christians are an important cog in the Republican coalition, and they are overwhelmingly Republican in their sentiments politically. The last three presidential elections, the Republican nominee has gotten at least 74% of the white evangelical vote, according to the exit polls. In fact, George W. Bush got 78% in 2004. Mitt Romney also got 78% of that vote. And they've formed about 25-26% of the electorate consistently over the last few presidential elections. So they're a very sizable block. And so you have like a state like Iowa, the leadoff state. They're going to play a huge role because in the last two caucuses, they've been between 56-60% of the Republican caucus electorate. So appealing to that group could pay big dividends in a state like Iowa and in much of the Deep South, where a huge percentage of the white evangelical population lives. So for a candidate like Ted Cruz, who's very much focused a large part of his campaign on appealing to those voters could find success. And I think that's actually an area where Donald Trump may run into trouble, because initially he was getting a lot of support from white evangelicals, but his support's actually cooled a little bit if you look at the polling since then. So candidates like Ben Carson and Ted Cruz have moved ahead of him in that group. But at the end of the day, Trump still is obviously leading polling everywhere. So he's picked up some support in other areas, but they're going to play a large role at the outset. The mitigating factor here for the influence of white evangelicals is that before the middle of March, the rules for the Republican from the Republican National Committee have forced the states to proportionally allocate their delegates based on the results. Now, the states have different ways of doing that, but generally speaking, it's going to be really hard to win a ton of delegates from one state. Some of the states do have winner-take-all provisions. Like, if you get a majority of the vote, you might win all the delegates from that state. But with the number of candidates we have in the field, it's hard to imagine someone actually doing that early on. So you have to get later on in the process. But when you get later on in the process, you do run in some states that have winner-take-all setups. Like, for example, Florida, which is actually a huge thing for Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush, is that if either of them is in the race and wins Florida, they win all the delegates from, I think, the state with like the fourth largest Republican haul. So pretty – I think the main point is that white evangelicals are going to play a big role, especially at the beginning, because
– So they may keep somebody in who
right
might otherwise leave, which is what we talked about a few moments
ago. If they consolidate their support behind somebody, which I think could happen with Ted Cruz. Because I think Ben Carson is sliding off a bit, and I think he's going to remain in the race in the sense that he's not going to just disappear or something. But I do think he sort of had his moment and may have fallen off now and may never recover. We'll see. But I'm not trying to mock Ben Carson, but the other day the Republican Jewish Coalition had this big meeting where all the candidates came up and spoke. He spent the entire thing, and obviously foreign policy has become a huge issue in this campaign. He spent the entire thing referring to Hamas as hummus, and he kept doing it over and over again.
Right.
And I mean, it's just those kinds of things begin to show up. And I don't think I think for all the criticism of Trump, Trump is confident in what he's saying, and that confidence can overcome any critiques about whether he's accurate or inaccurate. Carson doesn't have that same bluster, and I think that really does have an impact on people. So I think at the end of the day, Ted Cruz might be in a position to win a lot of white evangelical support, and if he does that, he could get into a position where, if the race comes down to two or three or four candidates, that it might give him enough of a delegate boost at the outset that he could be in a position to win the nomination. And I think that's also very concerning to the Republican establishment, because you may not realize this, but basically all the other senators in the Republican caucus in the U.S. Senate can't stand Ted Cruz, which is just kind of interesting, because I don't think they are all extremely fond of Marco Rubio, but all of them, a bunch of them seem to be coming out and endorsing Rubio now. Actually publicly endorsing it, or behind the scenes sort of saying, well, Rubio seems like our best shot.
Right, it's better him than the other guy.
Right, exactly.
Jeff Skelly with us today, part of Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball. This is WPVC 94.7, 1142.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, heating oil and propane for your home or business, and the award-winning Markets of Tiger Fuel, with 6 area locations.
And back in action here with our man, Jeff Skelly. Jeff, we talked about the last comment was Ted Cruz and how he's not particularly liked by some of the other senators. And we were speaking earlier about Donald Trump and how he's moved to the position of possibly actually being elected, but not necessarily being a liked being liked by the Republican establishment? Are we still in a time in politics where the establishment, the cigar-smoking guys in the background, can make sure that Donald Trump is not the nominee?
Yes, the smoke-filled rooms of yesteryear, or maybe still today even. I think that is really an open question, and that this election will probably say a lot about that. There's been increasing chatter in Republican establishment circles that we need to figure out a way to stop Donald Trump. We need to, like, pull resources. There's even been a super PAC set up with the stated intent of stopping Donald Trump. It hasn't gotten a lot of money yet, but it could become a vehicle for running ads that are specifically against Trump. And one of the reasons why we haven't seen all the candidates go after Trump in any kind of coordinated fashion is that no one really knows what the repercussions of that will be. What if Trump's numbers fall? Do they benefit? If you're a candidate, will that actually end up benefiting me or someone else in the field? And because no one can answer that question, because there are 14 candidates in the field, or 13 not named Trump, that has, I think people have been wanting to save their powder, if you will, for when we get closer to the election. Yeah, and so as in terms of the Republican establishment mattering, there is a thread of political science research based on a book called The Party Decides that has proven to be very influential in how we look at elections. And on the whole, elections have tended to – the nominees have tended on both sides to end up being the candidates that the establishment supports. Not always. There have been exceptions. 1964, Barry Goldwater is a very famous one. George McGovern was sort of a mixed bag story at the end of the day, but he had helped write the rules for the new primary process after the, you know, the gigantic disaster that was the 1968 Democratic National Convention, and set up the modern primary primary and caucus system as we know it today.
Three sentences on the 1968 mess. Well, give me the history. Me the history lesson.
The 1968 election. The best way to put it is, you had the Vietnam War going on, which had entirely divided the Democratic Party. You had conservative Democrats increasingly wary of backing the national candidate, and you had Hubert Humphrey end up winning the nomination. But at the Chicago convention, there were massive protests against Humphrey because he was viewed by many as a vehicle of continuing Lyndon Johnson's war in Vietnam, is how many of the protesters viewed it. And you had police brutality against said protesters from Richard Daley, the mayor of Chicago. Essentially, I mean, if you watch video of it, it's unbelievable. It's just, you know, it looks like a scene out of a movie, or, you know, a third world country with police and riot gear going through with wooden bats and just, you know, wailing on protesters to break them up. And so this was a huge disaster. So the Democratic Party looked to reform its rules. And so the McGovern-Fraser Commission set up the process we now know, where you go through and you have these primaries and caucuses, and the delegates are assigned based on the results in these. And the Republican Party, in 1972, they already had someone to back. They had the incumbent president, Richard Dixon. But in 1976, they sort of took on similar sets of rules. And now both parties sort of – that's how we've gotten to the point today where we are, where you go through this process. So with that in mind, you have the Republican establishment still has the Party Decides framework would suggest that while they're not picking the candidate in a smoke-filled room, there are lots of other ways that they are actually influencing what's happening behind the scenes in terms of you know, who they're going to back, of encouraging certain candidates to run and certain candidates to drop out, in terms of who they're promising money to, who their surrogates who are connected to donors are promising money to, and public endorsements. There's been a pretty stark relationship between who's getting the most endorsements and who's winning the nomination. Even Ronald Reagan, who had very mixed support from establishment figures, having challenged Gerald Ford, the sitting president in 1976 on the Republican side, even in 1980, he actually ended up with more endorsements than anybody else going into the actual process on the Republican side, and wound up being the Republican nominee. So there's been a large argument that this would work out. And at the moment, Jeb Bush has a slight lead on that score. But as I mentioned earlier, the number of endorsements he's had has trickled off a great deal. So now you're starting to see a lot of establishment Republican electeds backing Marco Rubio. His numbers have surged on that front, largely because he seems to be, for the establishment, maybe their best option if Jeb Bush isn't going to work out, which increasingly, having spent months spending millions of dollars in the early states, his numbers have not gotten better. In fact, they have gotten worse in places like New Hampshire and Iowa.
A lot of people talk about if the establishment does not allow Trump to take the nomination, that he would run as a third-party independent. But if we accept the fact that they may not have any control over whether or not he wins the nomination, he does win the nomination, there is no more smoke-filled back room. Is there a possibility of the third-party independent being an establishment GOP candidate?
Yes, we recently wrote up an article on this, and I would be skeptical that someone would run. But the thing is, you can't discount it. And there's been even public statements by some saying, you know, we probably wouldn't support Trump if he's the nominee. Not necessarily from elected Republican officials, but from Republican insider types. From actual elected officials, no one has said that. In fact, some have said sort of, yeah, we would back Trump because he's better. Any Republican is better than Hillary Clinton, sort of the party line. But at the end of the day, would they actually only really offer paper endorsements of Trump and wouldn't actually do anything to help efforts to elect him at the end of the day? And, you know, I would be tempted to think that might be the actual case for them. I think an important thing to just kind of relate it and that came to mind is that if Donald Trump is the Republican nominee, there are reasons to think that because of popular attitudes toward him and the electorate at large, that he probably would be in a tough position to win. However, there are many fundamentals in elections that we cannot predict this far out because we don't know where the economy is going to be. The Fed is probably about to announce that it's going to raise interest rates. Is that going to end up, you know, having a negative effect on the economy in the short term that could actually cause the economy to slide a little bit, which would probably dampen the president's approval rating, which is already kind of at the point where it might start to be trouble for Hillary Clinton, because it's very hard to run very far ahead of your sitting president who's from your party if he or she has a really poor approval record, approval rating. And these are things that we just don't know at this point. And it's impossible to know to some extent. Economists might claim they know, or you know, the World Bank says certain percentage growth is going to happen, but we can't know that for sure.
Right, which is why they all live in North. Yeah.
Yeah. So
they're not cashing in their lottery
tickets.
So,
you know,
either.
Trump, if nominated, Trump could become president. There's no doubt about that. You know, there are definitely circumstances where that could happen. And, you know, just kind of going along with that, it's like he could win the nomination and he could win the presidency. You know, you can't discount that. Absolutely.
Running out of time here. 11:51. I really should get better glasses. 11:51 here on the Sunday morning wake up call. This is 94.7 WPVC. You're welcome to dial us up. 284-9470. That's 94.7's phone number. It's 284-9470. Jeff Skelly here on the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. You know, you've mentioned several times about getting endorsements. Chris Christie recently got an endorsement from New Hampshire's, I guess, major newspaper. Does that sort of thing matter anymore?
Also an open question, because some would argue yes, in the sense that historically, the person who's gotten what used to be the Manchester Union Leader but is now the New Hampshire Union Leader, the changed the name of the paper, has traditionally ended up, and it's a conservative paper, has traditionally ended up actually winning New Hampshire primary, or at least more often than not. However, they did endorse Newt Gingrich in 2012, and that didn't work out. So on the one hand, I think what you have to look at it like this. Christie has gotten a lot of good publicity for his campaigning in New Hampshire There was like a YouTube clip that went viral of him talking about drug addiction, which is a really huge issue in New Hampshire. There's a big thing, particularly I think with OxyContin, that's been going on in New Hampshire that has really become like a top issue in that state. And this clip of him talking about what they need to do to address these problems went viral, and Republicans reacted very favorably to it. And as I mentioned earlier, actually his numbers in New Hampshire have improved, the favorability numbers and the poll numbers. There was actually a poll that just came out the other day that had him in double figures for the first time in ages. So he seems to be on a little boomlet here. Will it survive? We'll see. So kind of joining that in with the New Hampshire Union Leader endorsement, I think that is probably somewhat significant. But I think it is important to keep in mind that just because he got that endorsement doesn't mean he's going to go win. New Hampshire, I mean, that paper and all the others do not have the number of subscribers they once did. They don't have the levels of influence they perhaps had at one time when newspapers were like the main source of information for the public at large. Now they are well down the list.
And it's 2 months away.
Yes, and actually, this is a good thing that we need to make sure to mention, is that we are a little under 2 months. 57 days, I think, from the Iowa caucuses. Polls at this point only bear some resemblance to the actual outcome. And the national polls are essentially worthless in the sense they are worthwhile for the candidates, for fundraising, for showing that they might have a chance of winning. Absolutely. So they are important in that sense. But in terms of actual predictive value for who will win, the national polls are worthless. The state polls are a little better, but not a lot better at this point still even. So really, probably I would say roughly the point where the polls really may start to indicate what could happen on February 1st in Iowa is going to be like January 1st or just after New Year's. The correlation between the actual outcome and the polling results really starts to tick up as you get about 30 days out from Iowa. Just remember this. 60 days before the Iowa caucus in 2012, Rick Santorum was at 3.5% in the polling averages in Iowa. He never even led a poll, and he ended up winning. There's a lot of movement that can happen. And can you even trust the polling question asking if voters have sort of cemented their decision? There's no party ID to rely on like there is in a general election. Especially in such a polarized age, there's only going to be so much movement in the polls in a general election context in this day and age. Whereas in a primary, you're just kind of different shades of red in this case, of different Republicans. And so your decision as a Republican primary voter can move from one candidate to another without too much complication, in the sense that you're choosing between people that you largely agree with, and there's just little differences that you take into account when deciding who to vote for. But some new piece of information could come up that could cause you to shift in the next month and a half. So it can be a very turbulent process. And I think particularly New Hampshire has a long history of there being a lot of movement on either side. I remember in 2008, Hillary Clinton was losing in all the polls a couple days out because she had lost in Iowa. She'd finished third, actually, narrowly finished third behind John Edwards and Barack Obama. And then she came back and ended up winning New Hampshire. So the polling even a couple days before had proven to be suspect. So it's not an easily predictive thing. And it's because you don't have people sort of defaulting to their natural partisan inclinations, Republican or Democrat.
Does the crystal ball the crystal ball has Hillary Clinton as the, not 100%, but certainly the unmitigated leader.
Yeah.
Do you think that socialist attached to Bernie Sanders causes him to be so far behind, or is it strictly the name Clinton?
I think it's a combination of things. I think in Democratic circles, actually, the socialist label isn't really that damning for Sanders. I think what it is that people view him as having a lot of views that are pretty left, and it's not so much the label, it's his positions. And the Clinton name is huge, and she is sort of solidly in the middle of where the party is on issues. Like, she is comfortably ensconced between sort of the most moderate and the most liberal factions of the party. And that has enabled her to sort of get the most support. She also has strong backing from non-white Democrats, which they form a huge chunk of the Democratic primary electorate. And Bernie Sanders just isn't really in a position to make inroads there.
Do you think that the issues, have you read the article, seen the commentary from Liberty University's current chancellor?
Yeah, I saw those comments, yeah.
Telling his
students that they should
have concealed weapons so that we can end the Muslims when we see them. Do you think that some of the Republican candidates who have shaken hands with him, do you think that that will cause them to step away or step closer?
I think in the context of this election, I would think step closer. And that's just a reflection of the fact that the voters who are – another thing, all the polls are asking these questions about large numbers of voters that are asking – relatively large numbers of people who would you vote for? But at the end of the day, it's this sample that really only like a fourth of that sample will actually show up and vote. So is it really even that indicative of what's going to happen? And the fact of the matter is the more conservative voters are more likely to show up and vote. And so I don't think you're going to see anyone on the Republican side running away from that.
That's it, people. Go vote. That's part of the problem. Go vote. At least those of you listening to the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville should go vote. Jeff Skelly, thank you so much for coming in today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I hope you'll come back as we get closer to the actual date.
Sounds good.
All right, everybody. We'll be back next week. David Toscano will be here with us next Sunday on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Take care.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the Progressive Voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.